It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time with some recent bad news about common pain relievers, a UW nursing professor tells us about the latest research on alternative pain control techniques.
But first, the Obama administration announced new rules yesterday to drastically reduce power plant emissions in the next decade.
Reactions from both supporters and opponents to the Clean Power Plan have been swift. Here's what Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker had to say.
Well, first off, it's not the clean power plant, it's the costly power plant. It would be like a buzzsaw to the nation's economy. The states like mine and many of the other governors here would be devastated by that.
Clip there from the governor. As a result, Wisconsin plans to join a legal challenge to these new guidelines. Joining us to talk about the development is WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Well, Chuck, how would the president's clean power plan, as he calls it, affect Wisconsin?
Well, coal plants in the state, electricity generating coal plants in the state would have to cut emissions overall by about a third by the year 2030. Wisconsin makes a fairly sizable amount of use of coal. We're in the top 15 or so among states using coal to generate power. Somewhere around 60% of our electricity comes from coal. So the president's plan would have a significant impact here.
Now, reactions to the plan have been strong on both sides. First of all, who do you hear supporting it right now?
Well, largely it's the environmental and public health groups that have been active on climate change for several years, including the environmental group Clean Wisconsin. That group's director, Keith Riopel, served on a Doyle administration task force on climate change back when, you know, state agencies could talk more about climate change. Riopel is quite happy with the plan, and you know, he was not irritated that the EPA is giving states, including Wisconsin, a bit more time to come up with an implementation plan and its early reduction targets in emissions.
Now, with these goals set by the federal government for each state, what help is available for states to reach the goals that are being set?
Well, Riopel says a key one is that in this latest EPA announcement this week, states are being encouraged to get going on reducing CO2 emissions by going stronger on energy efficiency and making products, using products more efficiently and building more fuel more efficiently, and also the greater use of solar, wind, and other renewables.
Now, we have a clip here you were talking about from Mr. Riopel. Here it is.
There are incentives, and states can earn extra credit, let's say, by investing in energy efficiency and renewable energy prior to that 2022 starting date.
Now, he referenced these credits. Do you have a sense about how they would work?
Well, again, the more the states make use of them, the more credits they can get from the EPA, the more the energy generation goes to renewable, the better, the more favorable, presumably, the EPA we'll look upon things, presuming the next EPA administration is in line with the current EPA administration. And we should also note that also on board with the White House plan, Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters, which has started running ads discouraging Senator Ron Johnson from voting against any bill that would block the Obama rule. League of Conservation Voters say Johnson and Governor Walker are doubling down on their opposition to health benefits for many Wisconsin residents. We're also getting early support, signs of early support from the renewable energy industries, which would presumably benefit if states like Wisconsin made more use of wind and solar.
We're talking right now with WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach from Milwaukee, talking about Wisconsin's plan to join a multi-state lawsuit opposing the president's new clean energy plan. And at the beginning of the interview, we heard from Governor Walker there saying that he is clearly against this new initiative. This is something that the governor's been anticipating for a while. Has he fleshed out his reason for that opposition?
Well, he's just twice yesterday in both his presidential campaign in the morning and then his appearance in New Hampshire at a forum that at night last night, and that's where the clip originated, that the he's saying would have a negative impact on the state of Wisconsin, that electricity prices would really go up as power companies cut carbon emissions and switch to cleaner fuels. So Walker then asked late in the afternoon his official governor's office, because I guess a campaign for president can't ask an attorney general to do something and get much response, but the governor's office in the afternoon asked State Attorney General Brad Schimmel to intervene, and so Schimmel's going to join this multi-state lawsuit. None of this is a surprise, as you sort of indicated. Walker said he'd do this months ago. It caught Schimmel a little bit by surprise back then, since there wasn't a final rule at that point. Now there's a final rule, and apparently this lawsuit.
Now let's talk a little bit more about that lawsuit. Do we know what the grounds are for the lawsuit, what the argument's going to be?
Well, I think the main thing is going to be whether the EPA has exceeded its authority with some of the requirements, and that gets into the technical details quite quickly on that and legal details. But Attorney General Schimmel said yesterday that this rule would really be detrimental to Wisconsin's economy. So there'll be various legal arguments stemming on the projected impact on Wisconsin. National environmental groups, though, held news conferences late last week saying they think the climate change plan will survive, a basic contention that the EPA did not exceed its authority and that the U.S. Supreme Court told the agency it had the ability to regulate carbon emissions that in a decision a few years ago.
And Chuck, what are you hearing from opponents of the president's plan here in Wisconsin?
Well, the interest groups, besides the governor and attorney general, of course, the interest groups like Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's largest business group, saying many factory workers will pay with their jobs, WMC says, because of electricity rates, prices going up if companies have to buy from sources generating either from coal. In other words, if power companies are using these renewable sources, which WMC says may be more costly, that the big energy users would have to higher electricity costs and lay off workers. Americans for Prosperity, a group funded by the Koch brothers, if you will, said this is a federal takeover of Wisconsin's power grid.
And what do you see happening in the meantime? Does this, for instance, impact how agencies like the DNR do their jobs?
Well, it certainly seems to have put a bit of a chill on things. The DNR, in a statement yesterday afternoon, we are not going to be commenting on the CO2 emissions rule announced today because we need to thoroughly review the rule to make sure we know exactly, quote, what EPA is requiring Wisconsin to do. DNR then went on to suggest an argument raised by the electric utilities in the state, especially We Energies, that the state has already achieved significant reductions in CO2 emissions. If you go back to 2005, DNR talks about how the Focus on Energy program, the ratepayer-funded program, has helped the state become more efficient and more investment in renewables. So we haven't heard the technical end from the DNR. I think they're sort of pulling back and seeing what Governor Walker, presidential candidate Walker, is saying.
And does it sound like there is any mechanism in the plan for improvements done earlier, say back in 2005, that they might be credited in the future?
No. Well, I think that might be another part of the lawsuit, because I don't think right now there's a whole lot of early credit, just these additional incentives and help and delays for states like Wisconsin is where the EPA bent a bit.
And Chuck, just quickly before we let you go, what are the chances that the lawsuit will be successful, will prevail?
Well, again, the lawyers are lining up on both sides with the critics of the multi-state lawsuit, saying no chance that this EPA plan is fairly bulletproof. But there are judges that will have various stripes out there that will weigh in on things. And will we see carbon emissions cut by 30% by 2030? As one environmental group says, well, this is for our children, so I guess our children or grandchildren will see the benefits or not the benefits.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
That was WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach.
There's been a steady drumbeat of bad news about pain relievers over the last few years. Just last month, the FDA warned of increased heart attack and stroke risk linked to common over-the-counter pain relievers, brand names including Aleve, Motrin, and Advil.
That comes on top of concerns about addiction risk for prescription opiate pain relievers, the removal of Vioxx and other drugs from the market a few years back, and ulcer complications linked to many common pain medicines.
Some doctors have been quoted as recommending non-medicinal approaches to pain relief, leaving a lot of consumers consumers wondering what options are out there. Our next guest has been researching that topic. Christine Quackenboom is a professor of nursing at UW-Madison. She's done research on pain management alternatives for cancer patients. Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, I'm happy to be here.
Well, as I mentioned, your work is focused with on people with serious pain concerns. Cancer patients are receiving chemotherapy often. Are there lessons we've learned that might apply to the population at large when it comes to alternative pain management?
Yeah, absolutely. I think many of the non-pharmacologic treatments, although I'm using them for people with cancer pain, are applicable to lots of different kinds of both acute and chronic pain.
And you've worked with mind-body strategies. What led you to try that for pain relief?
What led me to my interest in that was working in the clinical oncology unit and seeing patients suffering with pain whose pain was not completely relieved by the medications they were receiving. I watched them and felt like there needed to be more that we could do to help them feel more comfortable. And so I looked to things that nurses could use or others that didn't require a prescription. So I got interested in strategies like imagery and visualization, which led me to learn a lot more about many different non-pharmacologic strategies.
Now, before we get into how those work, is this sometimes a hard sell to nurses and patients, thinking that something like meditation or imagery or things like that can do things that even pills maybe can't?
It is a little bit of a hard sell, but if you help people understand that pain is not just a physical experience, it's also a psychological experience, that pain is more than the uncomfortable sensation. It affects you emotionally as well. We can kind of get them to understand how these strategies might work and to have them try them and see if they work for them.
And for people in a situation with this kind of chronic pain, like in a cancer treatment situation, it's not necessarily an either-or we're talking about, right? It might be pain medication and these mind-body techniques.
Absolutely. In the research that we're doing and in the conversations we have with patients, we recommend that they use these strategies in addition to whatever medications they're currently taking. And often patients will tell us that they get even more relief by adding these strategies and can sometimes even decrease the amount of medications that they're taking.
And that's probably something that everybody is wondering now, if these sorts of things can let them use less pain medication. I know we're probably still early in the research, but that seems like a possibility.
You know, I can tell you that in cancer, we really haven't looked at that too much in terms of how much it's decreasing medication use, because we're really mostly concerned about people's symptom experience. So the kinds of outcomes that we're measuring are people's pain scores or other symptom scores and how much pain is impacting their quality of life.
Well, let's get into some of the techniques you worked with. And the first one you mentioned there was mental imagery. So So what's involved? What do people do?
Using mental imagery is just creating images in your mind, and they can be images that are distracting, that are pleasant, that take your mind off the pain for a period of time, or they can be quite focused on the pain itself. So, for example, if a person is having a burning sensation with their pain, they might create an image in their mind of a fire and then create a new image of a fire truck racing to that area and dousing the burning pain with cold water, and they experience the change in that sensation from a burning to a coldness.
So I mentioned the hard sell earlier, and I'm thinking, if I'm feeling a strong burning sensation and you tell me imagine this way, I'm going to be very skeptical. But the research you've done, it actually does seem to help?
Yes, we do see reductions in people's pain with these strategies. And as I said, we use them in addition to medication. So if someone's having severe pain, if you think about people rating their pain from 0 to 10, if people are having pain in the 7, 8, 9, 10 range, we want to make sure that they get some medications on board first and that we bring that down to a more moderate or mild level before we add psychological strategies.
So the medicine alone might bring it down to, I don't know, a 3 or a 4, medicine plus mental imagery, maybe a little further?
Correct. Right. And in studies that we've done, we see people with an average change of about 2 points on a 0 to 10 scale when they add these strategies on top of the medications.
Talking to UW-Madison nursing professor Christine Quackenboom about her research on alternative pain management. She's worked with cancer patients, says a lot of the techniques, though, might work for other people as well. Let's get back to some of the other techniques you've worked with, Christine. Relaxation is one. And that sounds like, again, easier said than done when you're dealing with pain.
Right. Well, one of the things that we know contributes to pain and makes it worse is anxiety. I have a colleague who, when he gives presentations about using these strategies and when he talks to patients, talks about stress and anxiety as turning up the volume on pain. We know that when we're upset, when we're bothered, our pain can seem worse than when we're calm. So by using strategies like relaxation, we can turn the volume down, and the pain is not as bothersome or irritating, doesn't interfere as much with the things that we need to do. So in our research, we use strategies like progressive muscle relaxation, where we have people tense and relax different groups of muscles and really focus on the sensation of the change, the difference between tension and relaxation. We also have just some really quick exercises like slow, deep breathing and jaw relaxation, where you relax the muscles of your face and jaw, and that can trigger a yawn and send relaxation throughout the body.
And it sounds like you're starting to knock on the door of meditation there as well.
A little bit. Meditation tends to be a more involved therapy than what we're doing in our current research, but there is a lot of interest in using meditation to be able to manage chronic pain in daily life.
And then one more technique I wanted to ask about that you've written about a little, distraction. How do you work to distract people from their pain?
In the research that we're doing right now, we use distracting nature images or sounds, things that take people's attention off of their pain. But we know that things like puzzles, playing games, being involved in reading a good book that you get really engaged in, you can lose track of other things that you're feeling at that time. And it doesn't may not make the pain completely go away, but it can bring it down to a level where you don't notice it as much.
Now, with all these different techniques, this sounds like kind of new frontier stuff, because I think in the past when we thought of pain management, we thought of a medication in pill form or intravenously, something like that. Are these ideas catching on?
Yes, I think that there's really growing interest for a number of reasons. One is that we're learning more about the fact that pain medications don't relieve all of a person's pain. And as you started this session, noting that there are some negative side effects associated with pain medications, so people are trying to use less. But we're also learning about the role of stress and inflammation in pain and other symptoms, and how a number of these psychological strategies can actually change the levels of stress hormones and perhaps some inflammatory markers in your body that may also be contributing to the pain physiologically.
And not just pain. You also studied along with this fatigue and sleep disruption that can go along with pain in the cancer patients in particular you've worked with. These techniques help with those as well.
Yes, that's right. We found that in people with cancer, they often experience multiple symptoms at any given time, and pain and fatigue and trouble sleeping tend to go together. They can be related. Sometimes one symptom can get worse because of treating another. If you take opioid medications for pain, there may be periods of drowsiness after that that actually make you feel more fatigued and can interrupt with your regular sleep schedule. So those symptoms tend to go together. So by using non-pharmacologic strategies and changing pain, we can also affect other symptoms.
In your research, are you seeing any sort of one-size-fits-all answers here, or are these things you're tailoring to individual patients?
Yeah, absolutely not. It's not a one-size-fits-all. What works for some people may not work for others. So in the research that we're doing, we specifically offer multiple different strategies so that people have a better chance of finding one that they really like or one or two that they really like and that work well for them.
And you mentioned training nurses. So how do you train a nurse, among all the other jobs that they have to do at a hospital, say, to work on things like relaxation and mental imagery and distraction techniques?
Well, actually, that's one of the things that we commonly teach in a lot of undergraduate nursing programs. So comfort is a really important nursing intervention and ways to help people be more comfortable when they're having illness and having painful procedures. So most nurses do get some training in their undergraduate program, and I think there's a growing interest in learning more about those strategies in practice. There's also a number of other healthcare providers who can help with these strategies as well. Social workers usually get some training in these strategies. Health psychologists have coping skills that they can teach patients as well. So it's not just a nursing strategy, but there are other people who can provide help with these treatments as well.
Now, you've worked with patients and nurses on alternative pain management. Have you heard before and after stories from either party involved? What kind of difference this makes?
I hear from patients, especially those who participate in my studies and stay in them and enjoy the strategies, that they really do feel like they make a difference. Some of the treatments that we're delivering now, we provide on an MP3 player, and we've had participants in our study ask if they can keep those MP3 players because they find them so useful to listen to these exercises and practice them whenever they need them. So I do hear good, positive feedback from a number of our participants.
So there's potential for, after a patient leaves the hospital or whatever facility, these are things they can maybe keep doing on their own, either with something they've been trained in or, as you say, on an MP3 player?
Yes. A lot of the exercises that we're using are things that people can learn to use on their own. The recordings that we provide have guided instructions, and so people can learn to do that without actually hearing the instructions anymore. For example, they can learn how to practice deep breathing without having a voice tell them to do it. So they can continue to use them after the study. We do give people the recordings that we use during the study, too, so they can continue to use them if they find them helpful.
Briefly, Christine, have you taken this into your personal life when you have, I don't know, a headache or something? Do you use some of the techniques you've been working on to try to deal with it?
Absolutely. I don't have a chronic pain problem, thank goodness, but I do. I was just at the doctor last week and needed to have blood drawn, and I did practice some deep breathing while they were poking me with a needle. And interestingly, when I checked in at that desk, there was actually a piece of paper assigned there that offered a number of different strategies to help people deal with the discomfort of having a blood draw. So things like vibration of the skin and distraction and puzzles, things that will get people's mind off of the discomfort.
Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure.
That's Christine Quackenboom, professor of nursing at UW-Madison.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Over the last couple of years, one of the most fiercely debated subjects in state politics has been education policy and funding. The changes that have gone into effect have had an impact on public schools, and now a group of principals are speaking out about it.
In a recent letter sent to Governor Walker and state legislators, more than 30 high school principals from southern Wisconsin signed on to make the case that reduced local control, among other things, is hurting their schools. They also say that the competitive nature and business model their schools now face is creating haves and have-nots and is affecting their ability to educate their students.
We're joined now by one of the signers of that letter. Mark Rolofson is the principal at Jefferson High School. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I understand that you were one of the people who initiated this letter-writing effort. Why did you decide to write this open letter?
You know, it's interesting, but there are so many ways to get a hold of legislators and get the word out. But oftentimes, I think a phone call from an individual might not carry the meaning that that a letter, signed by, in this particular case, 35 high school principals, ranging from very large districts like Heartland Arrowhead and Waukesha schools and Kettle Moraine to very small districts, Rio and districts that size. I think that it just may carry a little bit more weight, and we just felt that maybe that's the wise approach.
And what kind of perspective do you think you as principals bring to the table? We've heard from a lot of other voices as this has gone on, school boards, teachers, superintendents. What do we get from principals?
Well, we're kind of in the middle of the whole of this whole thing. One is we're firsthand able to see what's taking place in the classrooms and what's taking place with co-curriculars, everything from football games and FFA and music concerts, and we're at events. We tend to be the, especially in a rural community like this here in Jefferson, where you run into people, out on a Friday night fish fry. And I think that connection goes a long ways, and so you see that. And then also you sit in the meetings and you look at changes in statute and changes in mandates, and you take a look at what's happened with funding. And this is, goes back, much, much, for me, this is my 18th year coming up here and as a principal in this particular school district. And prior to Act 10, this isn't about Act 10, I see the changes when in 1992 when revenue limits hit. Economy at that point in time was soaring pretty strong, and all of a sudden we were starting to squeeze then. But be quite honest, there was fat to trim at that point in time. I certainly see that. I saw it at the time, and I certainly see it looking back retrospectively. But then all of a sudden it reached a point in the late 90s, early 2000s, where we started going, wow, this is starting to get pretty tight. We're seeing the difference. And then, boom, Act 10 hits, and 1.6 billion or 1.9 billion, $1.6 billion cut since Governor Walker has taken seat. And I look in this district alone, where 18 and a half certified employees just in our high school have been reduced since 1992. So that's over a long period of time, but a major impact. And so it's not just cut programs, it's not just cut opportunities, but it's also the fact that we have looked at bodies, and as a result, we see it increasingly difficult to meet the needs of today's standards.
And as presented, the governor said Act 10 was going to help school districts control those costs. Yeah, the cuts were there, but by limiting collective bargaining, there were going to be money savings too. Is that balancing out?
I would have to say no, it really has not. I don't see that has come to the benefit at this particular juncture.
So what you were talking about this cumulative impact of budget cuts from a time when, as you said, there's maybe some fat to trim until now. So what, from a student perspective, what are they going to see different in schools now in their education as a result of those couple decades of cuts?
Well, you know, you look at where can we potentially go with some cuts. Let me talk about any school district across the state right now where you eliminate opportunity for students. There's mandatory classes. So, you know, clearly the math classes and science classes and social studies classes are going to continue to get taught, and you could see class sizes increasing, and we've seen that. We certainly are reaching our point where we used to have class sizes of 18, 19 in a class, and you know, now all of a sudden we're looking at class sizes of 28, 29. That's much more common than it had been in the past, and that's an average. We see some higher than that and some lower. That certainly is a connection, but we've continued to try to maintain all of the programs that have been offered. As an example, we've tried to maintain clubs and co-curricular opportunities. But that's oftentimes the connection that kids have when all of a sudden they get an opportunity to soar in the arts or in music, in athletics, and we've maintained those. And in this competitive business model, you have to when your neighboring district is offering something, if you don't offer that as well, you're going to see the flow of students. They go to where that opportunity is, and that becomes a significant issue. And so people are just stretched thinner. Back when we had 18 and a half more certified employees just in this high school, that was more coaches. That was more teachers, less preps for teachers. I see teachers just flat out getting burned out. Teachers teaching, you know, four or five different preps over the course of a school day is a tremendous amount. When I say prep, I'm talking about four or five different courses to teach on the day, and in some cases, six different courses to teach on the day. That's a tremendous amount, especially when today you don't walk down the hallway and see lectures like you used to. This is not setting up a class where it's sit and get. It's hands-on. There's learning circles taking place at the elementary levels, high school level, more collaborative learning. All those types of things take a tremendous amount of time to prepare for. And now we have fewer teachers to teach all those different courses, fewer teachers to serve on committees, fewer teachers to run after school clubs and organizations, and kids that need extra help. Let's face it, we've got families that are potentially struggling, no matter what those struggles might be. And I think we have a duty to our students to be that eye and that ear for our community to help our kids out.
I'm talking to Mark Rolofson from Jefferson High School. He's principal there. He's one of a group of 35 high school principals who signed a letter to the governor and state legislature about problems they see in school policy funding, and not just funding. Mark, you also are concerned with state mandates, things that are required by the states overriding local control of school districts. Why is that a concern?
Overriding local control, I guess you take a look at the list once. Certification, all of a sudden, that's become done at the state government level. Just recently, over the course of the last several months, athletic participation is now all of a sudden something that's being controlled at the state level. 3 years of math to graduate, 3 years of science to graduate. You know, what's interesting is that some of these are decent decisions. I don't have a problem with 3 years of math or science to graduate. In fact, personally, I think it's a wise decision. But is that a decision that should be made at the state level, or should our local folks have that kind of control? The calendar, that's been has been quite a while now, about 10 years or more, where the school calendar has been determined. Assessments, you know, 16 different days, I believe, was quoted in the paper. Heartland Arrowhead had unique schedules where the rest of the student body did not have learning going on because they had assessments taking place. We have 42 days on our school year at Jefferson High School where some sort of assessment is taking place. And I'm not talking about a chapter test at the end of a unit, but 42 days out of the year. Now, that does not mean that every student in the high school is taking a standardized test 42 days, but some test is taking place. ACT, required of all juniors. Our curriculum. So you've got assessment, you've got curriculum, you've got the calendar, certification. All those things are all of a sudden controlled at the state level. And you know, it's no wonder why school board members who are elected locally feel like they just don't have the decision-making power that they did years ago. And I'm not sure that's what was intended. You know, you think about why small government in local communities carries such a weight. It's because oftentimes, at least it's supposed to work, where they know what's best. And I don't think we can count on Madison or Washington to be able to tell us what's best.
When you took these concerns and others to your colleagues, other principals, what kind of response did you hear for them?
You know, it was all done via email. And so when this went out, that's all I simply did was just ask is, you know, here's an idea. These are some of the concepts and thoughts that would be shared in the letter to the governor and to legislators. And would you be willing to sign? And the vast majority said yes. There were a few that didn't, that were in the local area, because I certainly invited private and parochial schools to sign on as well. And I get it. You know, I can see where some of them may not. But, you know, there were 35 that said yes almost immediately. And so, well, we moved from there. We just hope to be able to have a bit of a voice. We'd like to be able to voice what our concerns are, because we're here. We're working in this environment. We see it day in and day out.
We're talking right now with Mark Rolofson of Jefferson High School, one of 35 high school principals who signed a letter to the governor and the state legislature outlining how changes to education they say have hurt their schools.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you support more local control for schools, or should the state have the final say? Do you think changes to educational policy in Wisconsin are creating haves and have-nots, as the letter writer suggests? And where do you see room for collaboration between principals of schools and lawmakers? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Mark Rolofson of Jefferson High School. He was one of 35 high school principals who signed a letter to Governor Walker and the state legislature. They say changes made to education in Wisconsin have created schools of haves and have-nots. And the principals say they're worried about the reduction in local control for schools.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in a school? Have you seen changes to budgets and local control affecting your school? Would you agree with some of the points these principals are bringing up in this letter? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Gary on the line in Muskego. Gary, hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
What do you think, Gary?
Well, I certainly want to thank the Jefferson principal for being on your show, and he built a strong case. The comment I have, though, is that you know, the bottom line is they're saying, well, we need more funding. And, you know, when you talk about state funding and the same issue with federal funding, you know, it's all a matter of prioritization. So, you know, the people that need health care say they need more funding. And, you know, they say we need more funding at the university level and more funding for the homeless. So that's the key. You know, every agency or group of agencies like schools, I don't doubt that they can build an effective case, and I don't doubt that their concerns are legitimate. but we're dealing in a world of limited resources.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. So, Mark, there are a lot of other budget priorities. Schools are just one of them. And within schools, there are priorities. So ultimately, you got to deal with the hand you're dealt, I guess.
That's a great comment. And there's a budget to balance, no doubt. And America and this state, local governments all over, have overspent for decades and decades. So it's a great comment, no doubt. I think that when it comes right down to some of the mandates, I mean, as an example, that 3 credits of math and science, as I mentioned earlier, that's now required. That decision was made and put into effect in such a quick hurry. There's a factor of hiring new teachers to fill those positions. You know, what happens with equipment? What about the training? What classes are going to get offered? What about computer and technology? All those types of things. Testing required across the entire state of Wisconsin for 8th graders, elementary and middle schoolers, and teachers that went to training for a long period of time and got set for Smarter Balanced Assessment. We had to make sure our bandwidth was right. We bought more computers, and then, boom, it was taken away, just like that. The millions and millions of dollars that was wasted in those decisions was just ridiculous. And so there is savings, and I think that if two-thirds funding had done what it was supposed to do, if the revenue limits, which was supposed to be 4 to 6 years or so, it's 23 years later, it was supposed to be a temporary piece. If those types of things were not made at the state level, we may not be in this position right now. And there are still things that can be done. Some of those mandates just get taken away and said, hey, you know what, leave that up to the local people. Leave that up to the local governments. They'll make the decision. They know what their communities need. They know what their children need. And they also know what they have for financing. And let them make the decision.
Gary, thanks for the call. Yeah. Sorry, I'll bring on another caller, yeah. Mark. We've got Dave in line in Franklin. Dave, hi.
Oh, hi. Am I on?
Yep, you're on. What do you think, Dave?
Oh, thanks. I love these guys being on the air. My wife teaches in the Franklin School District. And morale for the teachers there is at an all-time low. We need some people speaking up for education. I really applaud their efforts. But I hear a lot of talk about funding, and I see it from a different point of view. It's not a funding issue to me. It's more of a revenue problem. We don't have a budget or funding problem. We have a revenue issue where we're not seem to be willing to make the effort to invest in education like we used to. The state used to give quite a bit more funding to local school districts, and they've reduced that over the years. I'll hang up and listen to your comments on that. Thank
Dave,
you.
Thanks a lot for the call. So, Mark, if he's right, if this is a revenue problem, there are pretty much two options: more money coming from the state budget as part of that two-thirds mandate you mentioned, or changing the revenue limits, allowing more property tax, local property taxes, to be raised by school districts. Do you think either of those are real possibilities?
Well, I think those are. If you lift the revenue limits, well, we could raise the taxes here locally, and that used to be done. And so what's happening instead, I'd be curious as to whether government at Madison level is okay with this, but what's happening is you're just seeing more districts go to operational referendums in order to keep exactly where they're at. They're not looking to add new programs. They're just saying maintain what we have, no more cuts, let's keep our programs, and they go to these operational referendums to make it work. But that's not going to be a long-term solution. But if you lift revenue limits, that could make the long-term solution.
Talking to Mark Rolofson of Jefferson High School, a principal there, he and a group of 34 other principals of high schools wrote a letter to Governor Walker and the state legislature about their current concerns over budgets over the last couple of decades and state mandates on schools. And Mark, in that letter, you said, hey, this is all creating some haves among districts and some have-nots. So how is that playing out?
Well, school districts are measured on the success of our test scores. However, we get paid on how many kids are in our seats in one way. That's one part of the formula. And so in a business model, that would make sense. If you look at how McDonald's makes their money, they make their money on how many burgers are sold, and that's how they get paid as well. And in public education, if we're measured on the success rate of test scores, however, the enrollment gives us the dollars, but people aren't open enrolling necessarily specific to test scores. Research all over. I did my doctoral study on open enrollment and learned that culture, the safe communities, less bullying, those are the reasons people are coming into the school district of Jefferson. And yet we have high test scores. Our test scores in this district are very respectable. And at the same time, that doesn't connect. And I'm not sure you can make a competitive business model out of public education.
Have you been hearing from legislators since you and your colleague sent this letter out?
I have not. Not one yet.
Have you gotten any kind of response from students, parents, community members in your own district?
You know, it's interesting, but I haven't heard a whole lot. I've heard from some staff members. There's been a lot of activity on social media, on Twitter and Facebook, but it's been pretty quiet at this particular juncture. But, you know, overall, I think there's some pretty good support in this community for this kind of thing. So it'll be interesting to hear what people have to say once they start walking back in the doors here in a few weeks.
Briefly, are you optimistic that some of the changes you've seen can be reversed?
You know, I'm optimistic by nature anyway. I believe that there is a way, and I believe that that people do want to see their local communities be a thriving part of their community. And so I have a hunch that things will come together. But it's time to sit down, and maybe we can't make the decisions, but at least be part of the advising committee. It'd be nice to at least be able to offer our viewpoints on some of these big decisions.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Mark Rolofson. He's principal of Jefferson High School. He joined us to talk about a letter that he, along with 34 other high school principals, sent to Governor Walker and state lawmakers. In the letter, they outlined their concerns over the future of public education in Wisconsin and the impact of changes over the last 20 years to budgets and state mandates. Keep sharing your thoughts on this conversation over at the Central Time Facebook page. A lot of people who travel for work have to fill out those travel expense forms. And when you travel internationally, sometimes you got to fill out those cards at the customs station. You know, you're bringing back this and that. Turns out you even have to fill out these kinds of paperwork when you go to the moon.
Astronaut Buzz Aldrin, the second person to walk on the moon after Neil Armstrong, has been sharing some moon landing memorabilia on Twitter, including his travel reimbursement form and his customs declaration when he returned to port in Hawaii after splashdown in 1969. He claimed a whopping $33.31 in travel reimbursements. That's all.
Yeah, I thought the moon landing would be a lot more expensive. To be fair, though, his space meals and the transportation into orbit and to the moon were covered by his employer. And on the customs declaration, he and the crew declared that they were returning to the U.S. with moon rock and moon dust samples. They actually typed that out.
And more ominously, under the part where you declare the risk of spreading disease, he answered, to be determined.
Yeah, so no, I think, reported cases of moon fever yet. And that's only been, you know, 45, 6 years, something like that.
He was honest.
Yeah. And the bummer is, if they'd gone over just one more crater, they would have hit the duty-free shop on the moon and some of that famous moon tequila on the moon, on the rocks, on the moon. No.
Oh,
forget that. Abort that pun mission there.